Rob Wolf, Andy D's back, episode 38, Paleolithic Solution. How is the book?
It is mainly done. We are waiting for the copy editor to ship back his just kind of final look at the book, and he had a few recommendations, apparently on some structural elements in like the insulin chapter, and so we're going to consider maybe changing the order of some of the information, but man, it is close. I'm just wrapping up all the references, and we are almost there. It'll be off to the printer before we know it, and then should be back beginning to you know, like between the 5th and the 15th of August.
And I told you, Rob, that I don't think you need any references.
We're just making this stuff up as we go. So
it's all pseudoscience anyway. Just put a note in the back. We don't need no stinking references and move on. That's, I think, the most time-effective way to resolve this issue.
Totally, totally. We'll save a lot of paper, too. So
cool. And also, I hear, although we're obviously time staggering some of these recordings, you're actually going to make a little trip next week. What do you got going on?
Yeah, going and checking out the MoveNet expansion course. So Erwan will be crushing myself and several other people in the backwoods of West Virginia.
Well, I hope you make it out alive. That's why you've been training all this barefoot running, huh?
Well, maybe that's why Nikki just took out some life insurance on me. I don't know.
Well, you know, Rob, I used to work with a gentleman that every time he traveled, his wife would up the life insurance and then lower it back down when he was not traveling.
Nice. That's smart. It's got better odds than the pass line in craps. So
that
sounds
true.
Good.
But it's not near as fun to play, Rob.
Nope.
All right, cool. Well, we got a good group of questions. I am excited as always. I don't think we're going to spin you out too much. Although you may be sad that we are not going to watch the CrossFit games that are this weekend, but I think we'll survive.
Yeah. We're apparently banned at the gate, not on the guest list. So, we'll do other stuff like go to the MoveNat thing this weekend and all that jive. But good luck to everybody competing. I'm working with a couple of people who are competing this weekend, so I will be checking in on them intermittently. But definitely looks like it's going to be a good time for folks, other than the competitors. Everybody will have a great time except for them.
Yes, and hopefully it'll be less dusty than at the ranch.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But it would be hard to replicate some of the sketch factor that they had going on there with the downhill running course and Poison Oak and everything else. So it's bringing it into the arena is cool from a spectator standpoint, but I think it's going to tame it a little bit. So we'll see how it goes.
It's kind of like how cool Ultimate Fighting was before they had the rules.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, and you know what? I'm going to do a little CrossFit Games prediction. I predict you will see some sort of a handstand walk for distance and then also a bicycle in some capacity in that.
Riding a bicycle. Wow.
That's one of my predictions. Bicycles and handstand walks.
And so we're recording this July 15th, so we'll see, man. Rob Wolf said it, bicycles and handstand walks. See, the tough thing for me is like on the handstand walks, which I dig, how do you account for people falling forward? How do we judge that?
Probably like when they throw discus or do broad jumps, you have a judge there.
Right.
If they should tumble, then probably they're eyeballing where the, the hands were at the, the moment where they basically fall. So
right.
That would be my guess, yeah. Because otherwise it could just turn into a series of front rolls across the 100 yards or whatever it is. So
like the old Dan Fouts days in football where he'd fumble the ball ahead of him going out of bounds to get extra yardage before they outlawed that practice.
Yep.
All right, cool. I'm excited, Rob. Bicycle and handstand walks. Let's move to the questions.
Perfect.
I'm excited about this first question because I like the handle and this guy's funny. So anyway, first question is from Anonymous Ninja. Hey, Rob, you mentioned that you thought it'd be a podcast topic, so here I go. I got a pretty gnarly fractured foot with multiple breaks, possibly going to need surgery. The doc says 6 weeks to recover if it's just broken, 4 months to recover if the tendons need surgery. What's a CrossFitting ninja to do? Rob, I just need to pause here, and I feel like this is like Kelly Starrett's like influence written all over it. No one else walks around saying CrossFitting Ninja as much as that man does. Anyway.
I'll have to defer to your expertise on that completely.
So, what's a CrossFitting Ninja to do? Surely martini mixing for time from the comfort of my couch will improve my understanding of elite fitness, but what about my foot? I've done some research on GH therapy and fracture healing, and as expected, GH injections speed recovery. However, in my research, I also found a bit of information about peptides, and I'm not going to read the specific peptides because I think, you know, people can look at those.
They're a mouthful. Yeah.
It is my understanding that using a combination of peptides, one could trigger their body to release more GH, thus avoiding the shutdown that commonly accompanies hormone manipulation. Is there a safe way to use peptides? What would be an effective method of using them for bone healing? Is there an established dosage that would be safe and effective? How should they be used? Cycled? How much would it shorten my expected recovery? Will Bella change her mind and leave Edward? What is the proper method for mixing a gin and Progenics martini? Thanks, Rob.
Oh, man. That covers all the bases, I guess.
First of all, Rob, will Bella leave Edward?
I doubt it. And the Progenics martini is just serve it cold.
All right, now to the important questions.
Oh, man. So this is a biggie. You know, I had to do a lot of research on this to even take a stab at answering it. And like the lot of the protein, GHRP6, growth hormone releasing protein 6 and 2, and the couple of other peptides that he mentions in here. One thing, it'd be really hard to find a doctor that would really get in on this, and it would be massively expensive. So, I mean, if you've got money to burn, you could certainly give it a shot. The thing about this, though, is that you can elevate the growth hormone levels. You definitely will have increased recovery in general from that route. But chronically elevated growth hormone actually can make you very, very insulin resistant, too. So there's some stuff that you might want to keep in mind with that. Like it's not 100% a free lunch. So abnormally elevating the growth hormone could certainly be a problem. And then there's this other side of it that if you just tweak and push things in the direction that you'd like to see them go via exercise, I think that you would still get much better healing, whether you need surgery or not. If you're just generally exercising to the best of your ability, you can still put together some largely upper body circuits, some work with the opposite leg, and still get some of these really nice pulsatile growth hormone responses to the exercise. And you're pumping nutrients, pumping blood through the area, so the nutrients are going to be carried in there to help speed recovery. Make sure your magnesium intake is solid, plenty of protein. Veggies that have tons of calcium in them and stuff like that. And to me, that seems like a much lower level of intervention to do all this and not suffer any side effects. Like some of the peptide therapy just seems kind of wacky. Like it could certainly work, but it's rare that you get these trying to intervene into a complex system like this that you don't get some sort of a downside to it. And there's just not that much research on this yet to tell one way or the other if it's a kind of a free lunch sort of gig or if there's some other downsides just from the proteins themselves. I would still, again, say that chronically elevated growth hormone could be problematic from an insulin sensitivity standpoint.
Sure. In either case, Anonymous Ninja maybe gets the fourth best handle we've ever had and perhaps the funniest question.
There's some goodies in there. Yep.
Maybe you can throw up a recipe for gin and Progenics martini, and that could be your third most popular drink recipe ever released by Rob Wolf.
We could give it a shot. Does Progenics come in chocolate?
I don't know. I assume it does.
If not, we can just throw some cocoa in it. So, yeah. We'll give it a shot.
That would be funny. In either case, we'll feed it to the cat and see how it goes.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Next, we got a question from Marco. Rob, love your work and the podcast are kicking ass. Sorry for swearing. I have two questions. One, what's the deal with organic quinoa from True Roots purchased at Costco? Does quinoa qualify for the paleo diet? And to clarify from today's July 6th podcast, a paleo diet doesn't have to be a ketogenic diet?
So tackle number one, which actually has two elements to it.
I didn't want to be rude about his numbering scheme.
There's an artistic license going on here with the numbering scheme. So quinoa, it botanically, it's a fruit. It registers pretty much as a grain. It's definitely yummy, but it has some pretty potent saponins, which damage the gut lining in a different method than what gluten does. Gluten and similar lectins actually get transported into the gut or through the gut into the interstitium and into the body by attaching to some transport molecules. Quinoa, by contrast, has an anti-nutrient, we'll call it, that's a saponin that instead of getting transported through the gut lining, it actually just kind of punches a hole through that phospholipid bilayer. Like it opens up a hole in the cells themselves, and it just kind of irritates or erodes a hole through that intestinal lining. So it's not, again, you know, different people respond to it to different degrees. People typically soak quinoa to remove the saponins, and it looks soapy, hence the name, but you never remove all of it. So, I mean, it push comes to shove. Like, I would definitely eat quinoa over any type of wheat product. Like, it seems to cause much less problem for me than wheat does, but it still is kind of problematic from that gut irritation standpoint. And then I guess question two, from the paleo diet doesn't have to be a ketogenic diet. There's big assumption out there, it was all that I was commenting on, that if you are eating a paleolithic diet, it is by default a low carbohydrate diet. It's carbohydrate agnostic. You take in as much dietary carbohydrate really as you need to support activity, try to make it a nutrient dense, low carbohydrate yield for the most part, except for, again, when you're enhancing performance, and that's pretty much it. So it doesn't really, paleo diet, just, you know, carb agnostic, doesn't really matter what the carb intake is, it's just based off your needs.
Right, so in other words, paleo diet is based on food quality, not necessarily quantity per se, is what we're saying.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Unlike the magical zone, for example.
Yes.
Cool.
Correct.
All right, and now on to question kind of two, Marco. What are your views for an optimal fitness program for someone in BJJ? CrossFit football O-lifting is crushing my BJJ performance. Would CrossFit, main page, or yoga, or plyometrics and bodyweight be a better option? Thanks, Rob. Keep it up. We are all learning, and you are making a difference.
Cool. It's good to know. this is a timely question because I've started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu again, and I definitely had to modify my training significantly to just survive the volume and the impact of doing JITS training. I'm 38. I feel like I'm in good shape. I definitely eat well, but it's definitely a whole other kind of world coming in and doing this stuff at this point. I wonder also, like because jiu-jitsu is so kind of lactate demanding, it kind of works in that lactic acid metabolic pathway so much, kind of full body intensity. I know I've driven into some overtraining in the past, so I'm kind of wondering if part of my deal here is just having overtrained in the not too distant past. So that's kind of interesting. But what I've been doing is kind of a modified Windler, in which I do the strength work. I'm doing dips and pull-ups on one day, so I actually do two movements on that day. I'm doing squats on another day. Let's see here, and then standing press and rope climbs on a third day, and then just the deadlift and power cleans on a fourth day. And one or two of those days, I would occasionally make like a small couplet, like on the power clean deadlift day for a couplet, I would do three power cleans and then a 40-meter sprint, then walk back and do rounds of that in 20 minutes. One day I was doing like a long run for me, like an 800-meter, usually two repeats of that, and then doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu 3 days a week. And what I ran into was that any type of volume on my strength and conditioning days, anything that kind of looked like a Metcon kind of circuit training type stuff, would get me into the deep end of the pool training, overtraining wise, like really, really quickly. And so part of it, you know, I wanted to do some extra work to try to get in shape a little bit quicker, but the reality has just been it's taken me about 6 to 8 weeks to get back into jiu-jitsu shape, and now I'm getting to where I can roll for 20, 30 minutes straight without too much, you know, I mean, I'm suffering pretty bad, but I can actually do it, whereas like if 5 minutes of rolling in the beginning was crushing my world. And so it's just taken some time to ramp up, and you can't force that process. You can't do too much. And so from there, I think what I've kind of defaulted to are usually some sort of a Wendler-esque max effort for a particular movement plane. And so like I do a press and a pull on the same days, and then like a quad dominant squatting movement sort of deal, and then a hip dominant deadlifting sort of deal on a different day. But I do just pretty low volume, and I'm actually thinking about shifting gears and doing a little bit more like Coach Rutherford's max effort black box, just in that it will tend to be a little bit lower volume. Like I feel like even the Wendler gig, like on my deadlift day, I got 13 reps, which you wouldn't think that that would be a ton of volume, but it ends up kind of smoking my hamstrings for the next day doing jiu-jitsu. So I might play around with dialing the volume down even smaller. And then basically 3 to 4 days a week of JIT, or 3 days a week of JITs, 3 days a week of training, doing strength work. And then probably one of those days, like an interval run or an interval row, but more aerobic intervals than anaerobic intervals, almost like a recovery day, maybe spackled on the end of another strength session. So that's kind of the way I'm tackling all that, and maybe you know that could give you some direction on that. There was a really good thread on the performance menu, basically summertime workout for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and there's some great ideas, great templates floating around on that thread.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to think about is on kind of for Marco on an individual basis, like if you know what sport you're competing in and you kind of know where you are, we should be able to work backwards from what physical qualities you most desire related to that sport.
Right.
So
right.
You can kind of at a macro view, like, do you need more of this? Well, if so, you're going to need to spend some time doing it. If you don't need it, then you may need very little, whatever, flexibility work, as an example. If you're as mobile as you feel like you need to be, it's not going to take much work to maintain that, probably.
Right. Totally.
So I also feel like, you know, working backwards can be helpful to give some direction, because obviously you're only going to spend so many hours on your kind of supporting S&C related to your sport.
Totally.
All right, good question.
Yeah.
Or multiple questions, Marco.
Sliding them in under the radar.
We'll have to have specific rules in the future. No, just kidding.
That would be rather formal for us.
I know. That's why it's a total joke, because it'll never happen. Maybe at episode 100 we'll make it formal.
There we go.
Next, we got a question from Mark. Hey, Rob and Andy, loving the podcast, though have been feeling a little jealous of your reports of hot weather. Morning temperatures have been bottoming out around 25 degrees Fahrenheit here in Western Australia. To inoculate ourselves against the cold weather, my wife and I have been enjoying a cup of cocoa after dinner. Definitely works on warming up our bones. That said, we are wondering what sort of effect this medication has on insulin release and insulin resistance. I've researched it online, however, the studies I have viewed seem to provide conflicting advice. Your advice will be greatly appreciated, as we are keen to avoid putting on a winter coat.
I'm assuming that this is unsweetened cocoa. Like, if it's unsweetened, then there's really not any type of issue with that. Cocoa is actually kind of an interesting antioxidant. It has some theobromine, which is kind of makes you feel all happy and in love and all that, but it's a little bit stimulating. Synephrine and some other alkaloids in the cocoa are fairly stimulating, so it could keep you awake at night, but other than that, it shouldn't be a problem. If it's a ton of sugar in it, then that might be an issue in the evening, or if you do like a half a teaspoon of sugar or something, it's not really all that big a thing. Just depends on how the whole deal is set up, and if it's generally low-ish carb, it's probably not that big a thing.
Yeah, and given the weather here, I think I could enjoy a few mornings of 25 degree Fahrenheit weather.
Seriously, it's getting what is it in Celsius? We're around like 40 degrees now.
Yeah,
so it's right. It's getting toasty.
And Mark lives in Australia, so not a bad place to be.
Exactly.
Okay, good question. Drink your cocoa. Next, we got a question from Carl. Love your MP3s. Learned a lot. I'm on episode 8. Wow.
Dude, the punchline may be good at this point.
Do you think krill oil can be used instead of fish oil? I love krill, and it helps with my wife's PMS. LOL.
Is he using a pseudonym on this? Or is...
I don't know. I should respond to his email and harass
him. I'm just going to clobber him. You know, the two are pretty interchangeable. Krill oil also has some interesting carotenoids in it that are pretty cool. Zeaxanthin, astaxanthin, a couple other carotenoids typically. My only nervousness about krill oil is like the krill is just kind of like the base of the food web in the ocean. I have some nervousness about like getting out and fishing that, and I don't know if it's at all based in reality. Like I have no idea if our harvesting of krill could actually impact it, but it makes me a little nervous from that standpoint. Other than that, I see the two types of oil as being largely interchangeable. So,
all right. Fair enough. It always comes back to the krill. I blame the Eads for that question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they got in with it and kind of promoted it, and props to them for doing that, but I just don't see a huge distinction with it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And next question, are you at odds with Cordain regarding sweet potatoes and yams? What is your reason to include them if they weren't on the paleo diet? Thank you.
You know, in the original paleo diet, Professor Cordain just mentioned sweet potatoes and yams were kind of on the no-fly list because of the starch content. I think he's, you know, everybody in that camp have kind of modified their position. We maybe even understand that starchy roots and tubers may be preferential to fruit because of the way that fructose modifies liver metabolism and the metabolism of glucose. So it, you know, it. I think originally this was just kind of trying to avoid starch, but we understand that the that main issue was kind of an outgrowth of starch related to grains because of lectin impact on insulin sensitivity. So I think this whole position has just kind of changed over time.
Yep. And people change their minds.
Yeah. And I mean, it also it's one of those things to just kind of play with and see what your needs are with it.
Yes. Cool. Good question.
Yeah.
Next we have, man, these jokes are never going to stop. Next we have a question from Nick. Wonder if I'm listener number 9. Have you hit double digits? Tell Andy I don't think the joke will ever get old. Thank you for encouraging Rob, Nick. I really appreciate that.
I kind of like it too. I mean, I'm kind of warmed up to it. So
it's kind of like the internet is the pool, and it's out there. It's never coming back.
Yeah.
Yep. Two questions, and so he provides a couple links. What is your take on this? And this is a link about the effects of ketosis and low carb diets. And then he says, also, are the symptoms listed here a good checklist to know when your body is kicking the carb fuel to the curb?
So. Trying to get a full handle on this. So what the heck? Oh, you know what? That website I had this website open. So Andy, what's the specific question he's trying to ask here?
I think he wants to know. So the first one that kind of has some effects of ketosis, and I think he's kind of looking for the accuracy. Like this first one, signs of ketosis. It's like ketosis is an emergency state. Kind of talks about the differences between normal metabolism. Obviously, we got some video on this site.
Right.
Man. Rob, why don't you just... I'm going to close that because people don't listen to that awesome music. Why don't you give your quick thoughts on ketosis, good or bad, and signs of ketosis?
You know, I'll go signs first. Usually, I won't say usually, the entrance into ketosis can range anywhere from like horrific to relatively easy based on how the individual was eating and where their insulin sensitivity is. If they're very insulin resistant, getting into ketosis can be kind of rough. Basically, they've been running largely on carbs, probably have some metabolic derangement. And then whether or not ketosis is good or bad, I suspect, and there's some interesting research that would support this, that ketosis is kind of the default metabolic state to some degree. At least we should be going into ketosis some of the time. It appears to improve some of the metabolic like stability of the brain cells. There's this stuff lipofuscin, which builds up in cells, which is part of the aging process, and ketosis helps the cells to remove lipofuscin. It has some really cool effects, some of it related to anti-aging, anti-cancer, and stuff like that. So when you throw ketosis into this idea that it's somehow dangerous or like an emergency state or something like that. Like, people really don't understand what it is, even just understanding the distinction between ketosis and ketoacidosis, which is a metabolic state that can kill you, but it's when you become insulin resistant, ketone bodies get very, very high, and blood glucose gets very, very high. Because you're so insulin resistant, you can't really get anything into the cells. Like, you can't get ketones for fuel, you can't get sugar into the various cells for fuel, and the brain can die. Parts of the brain can die. But that just doesn't happen when we tackle this from the perspective of like a ketogenic diet. Yeah. Signs and symptoms, you know, usually people see some decreased energy, particularly with metabolic conditioning type stuff, like very heavy strength work they can usually do, aerobic work they can do, but anaerobic work is pretty challenging.
Cool. Nick goes on to say, started the paleo diet a few days ago, have eaten lean meats and a few carbs, only from a few chocolate squares, have a sweet tooth. Goal is to lean out, or more accurately, drop some pounds. I'm planning on working vegetables back in over the coming weeks with some fruit here and there. Any thoughts or suggestions? I would refer to Lauren Cordain's The Paleo Diet book, which I read before starting paleo. Only my puppy thought it was a great chew toy and haven't made it back to the bookstore to buy another copy. So, Rob, any thoughts on starting paleo?
Good idea. it's just simple. Meat, veggies, good fat, meat, fruit, or yam, sweet potato post-workout. Eat until satiety. If you really want to lean out, then eat just a smidge short of satiety, and it's damn easy. So, if you go to Paleo Brands, or my frequently asked question links to it, there's a really slick getting started on that. I know Whole 9 has a get started. Mark Sisson has a great get started. I mean, there's a million, how to get going on this sites or blog spots on that.
Yes, and I like the we'll put up some links. Like, the Whole 9 released their new Whole 30 version 2.0 and some stuff like that, which is pretty good. So we can put some links up for that.
Cool.
Whole 30. Okay. And Nick goes on to say he is missing milk, and he provided a link. If you haven't heard Lewis Black perform, he has an interesting term for milk in one of his comedy performances. Many thanks to you and Andy, even though he will not be paying attention to the answer if you use this on the podcast. Nick is a very smart man.
Yep.
And have you ever watched that Lewis Black thing, Rob?
I have not.
It's pretty funny because there's some parts where he's like, you know, when I was growing up, there was no question about milk. You knew it was good. You had four glasses a day. There weren't all these versions of milk out there now, you know. It's kind of humorous. Lewis Black is a pretty funny dude.
That's
so
cool.
Cool. All right. Good question, Nick. Next, we got a question from Steve. Hey, Rob. Love the show. Quick question. I try and eat as paleo as possible. However, like most, I've done an occasional or more than occasional slip. I have had allergy tests done, and according to them, I'm not allergic to any foods, including wheat or any nuts. I also seem to have no medical issues, i.e. cholesterol numbers and triglycerides are all good. I have no ailments. I am lean and perform well. I would be considered a very healthy person. However, I do have a fair amount of stress. I'm concerned about long-term health, and if I have no allergy to any food, how dangerous can those cheat days be? Will wheat or gluten or peanut butter have the potential to cause damage down the road? Is there a possibility of a silent autoimmune condition that could rear its ugly head down the road, etc.? I know it is impossible to predict what, if any, ailments will come up, but didn't know if you had seen any research or had any thoughts on this. Thanks.
Well, in the book, I mention a pretty interesting study where some immunologists, rheumatologists looked at kids who had developed type 1 diabetes, and they looked at the cross-section of their intestinal lining, and usually they're looking for like a WGA antibody test, a wheat gluten antigen antibody test, and that's kind of one of the gold standard diagnostics for celiac disease. Also just a positive enteropathy biopsy, in which you see the villi and the microvilli are damaged in a characteristic way with celiac. So those are kind of two of the gold standards for diagnostics. There's also a blood test, which isn't nearly as accurate and whatnot. But what this study showed, it was kind of interesting. Some of the kids, a pretty high fraction, had overt celiac. All of the kids had type 1 diabetes, which we now, you know, understand, or we've known that it's an autoimmune disease, but we're starting to really get this sense that there's probably a big dietary component to this. So a number of the kids already had celiac. Several of them did not, however, obviously, you know, like it was about a 50-50 split on this, or like a 30-70 split. But the interesting thing is that all of the kids had a positive test for an antibody to transglutaminase, which is a type of enzyme which modifies proteins after they're manufactured by the ribosomes and before they're spread throughout the cells. And so all of these kids had problems with transglutaminase. And what the take-home message out of the study authors was that it was a very high likelihood that the bulk of the kids who had type 1 diabetes would also develop what we would call celiac at some point. And then even in the kids who didn't develop celiac, they had identifiable gut pathology, inflammation occurring. And the deal with the, you know, gluten specifically, but other lectins have this issue also, is that they attach to a specific receptor site. These receptor sites are usually used for transporting nutrients. And it just happens that these undesirable proteins also attach to this receptor site, stimulate the receptor site to bring this anti-nutrient into the gut. Some people end up developing, you know, really severe problems like an autoimmune disease, like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, et cetera, or celiac. Some people don't get a disease like that, but they definitely have still identifiable gut irritation and pathology. So, I mean, there's always the potential that you could develop this. It almost certainly is causing some gut pathology. And here again, just referring to the primal body, primal mind, where she's saying upwards of 6 months after a singular exposure to gluten. And yep. I still haven't read that. I'd still like to follow up on that stuff, but that's really intriguing. As an order of operations, I would just put gluten-containing items pretty far out there on the, like, definitely avoid list. And then things like peanut butter occasionally and like corn tortillas and rice and all that. Like, I just don't see much problem with like a once a week consumption of that stuff in general. If you're lean, you're not showing any signs and symptoms of inflammation. So I think maybe for Steve, this all boils down to mainly just avoid gluten, make your cheat meals, you know, more beans, rice, you know, corn tortilla type thing, and probably not that big, you know, not much to worry about.
Right. Cool. All right. Next, we have a follow-up from our friend Christina. So here we go. I'm going to try to read this. It is a mouthful. I may slip up a few times. Rob,
I may fall asleep during this thing, so wake me up when you're done.
No judgment. She says, thank you for asking the question for Rob and you to discuss. I would never even considered any thyroid issues with her. I forward her the link to listen to it, and here's her follow-up. Wow, thanks. That was informative. I have to tell you that I've had all blood work done and levels checked, and of course that was my first response to my first bike crash. But including thyroid, all was level and good. So when I began supplementing different minerals, because that's what my thoughts too. So I've been doing that and no change. I also need to tell you that my whole body doesn't seize up at once, just legs or grip or whatever, randomly depending on what I'm doing. I still think it might be related to dehydration, but not sure. I went to a lady who put me on a machine to see what was going on. It's like, Christina, it's like a magnetic thing around the wrists, ankles, and forehead, and it reads all types of stuff in your system. Sounds crazy, but it's legit. Anywho.
Oh, man.
Anywho, she said I have excess lactic acid in my muscles as well as androgens, and she said I need to do a liver detox. She said my liver is overloaded. Also, I have a large amount of saturated fats from former diet, I guess, and the brain was holding onto a large amount of metals in the fats in the brain, especially copper, so she wants to get all that out. I need to take a breath now. So, I'm on the liver detox now. I'll let you know how it all works out. I have low vitamin D, so I upped that, added B-complex. I was way over on my testosterone and low on estrogen, so the hormones are not making it better. I'm going to try to get that balanced. I'm just a mess, it seems. I have lost about 13 pounds and have not tried to lose more, just kind of in a hold pattern for now. Still struggling to poo, but trying glucomannan fiber, and that's helped some. I can't think of anything else to tell you. I'm going to listen to the show again, and if I do write you then, thanks again for caring and helping me so much. Your sweet gal, Amy.
Holy cats.
Take a shot, Rob. Holy cats.
Oh, that's right. There's a drinking game. We'll have to tell people about that. I feel like I need a hug after this. I don't know. I feel just a little bit traumatized after this, man.
I don't know what to say, Rob. do you have anything valuable to add at this time, Rob? Let me just stay there.
The whole band magnetic thing around the forehead just sounds creepy. That's all I can say about that. Sounds dangerous and creepy.
Yeah, and in spite of the fact that I'm laughing, Christina, please have your aunt keep us updated on what's going on, because we are actually seriously interested and always willing to learn new stuff. Not sure about the bands.
And definitely willing to make sure of her again. So keep it coming in.
Performance art, Rob. The microphone was one too many steps away.
Oh, man. Man, oh, man, oh, man.
All right. So now on to another hilarious topic.
Hopefully.
Question from Craig. I don't believe you've addressed this, and there may be a reason, but I was reading on the alleged benefits of wheatgrass juice today. Do you know anything about this? Have you heard of benefits from sources you trust? Would you ever attempt to ingest it, risking gluten contamination?
Wheatgrass is kind of interesting. It's got superoxide dismutase and some really cool antioxidants. It's kind of some concentrated chlorophyll. The gluten issue, people will swear up and down that you cannot get a gluten from this, basically wheatgrass, because when you start sprouting the blade of grass, that all the proteins are broken down and the nutrients are kind of redistributed, changes around, because now you have a living, growing plant, basically, and then you juice that thing. I've noticed a lot of people, I've never really tried it, just for fear of like a bad reaction, but there are a number of people that comment that they have problems with wheatgrass if they are already gluten intolerant. And then there's my other thing with this, which is kind of like, what about broccoli and kale and spinach? You know, the thing about the wheatgrass is that I don't see anything unique there that you can't get out of some other foods that we know are fine.
So. Obviously, the only thing better than wheatgrass is Monavie.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. And if anybody would like me to tell them about an opportunity to buy Monavie.
Rob Wolf, I've seen that Monavie car sticker on your car.
No, that's not my car, man. Somebody else's car.
We're going to get hate mail now.
Yeah, we will. We will. Half the listenership is like, those guys are jerks. Salesmen.
All right. Thanks, Craig.
Yeah, totally.
All right, next we got a comment from Kyle. Hi, Rob. Been doing paleo for 2 months. I was lean to begin with. I didn't have any problems for the first month, but for this last month, I've been going through bouts of stomach pain, usually after eating. It is quite unpredictable, but it is general discomfort in the stomach area, aggravated by moving and kind of nauseated. It is usually at worst at night and seems to result from eating and gets worse throughout the day, but it is worse some days than others. Even if it isn't bad, my stomach just isn't right. I've been able to pinpoint nuts, especially cashews and avocados, as a problem, but cutting that out doesn't relieve my stomach problem. I did not have stomach problems before going paleo, and as I said, I didn't have trouble for the first month. I cut out grains, legumes, processed food, sugar. I jumped into this 100%. I eat veggies at every meal and a source of protein. Free fats come from olive oil and coconut oil. 6'1", 180 pounds, active, trying to get about 150 grams of protein, 150 grams of carbs, with the rest of my calorie needs from fat, which I find hard without going crazy with coconut oil and olive oil, especially since avocado and nuts became the enemy. I'd really like to eat paleo, but my stomach was happier eating copious amounts of grains, low fat, low protein. Do you have any insights as to why my body is rebelling? Thanks.
That's weird. The fact that he started off okay and then things shifted, definitely there could just be some kind of long-term irritation from, you know, maybe like a cashew problem, some sort of a nut allergy kind of thing. There is definitely a problem for some folks if they do too much raw vegetables, that can be a little taxing on their digestion. They might benefit a little bit from cooking the veggies, you know, like squash and all that stuff. Make sure it's better cooked, broccoli. You know, you can play around with this and just try cooking everything for a period of time and cook it pretty well. And then reintroduce, one, you know, hopefully you get some alleviation in the kind of GI problems. But then if you reintroduce raw vegetables, then, you know, maybe the problem pops back up. Definitely seems like an argument for trying some of the now food super enzymes, just like tracking down that couple of podcasts back. Was it 33 that we went over the how-to, or were we back a little earlier than that? But we definitely covered the how-to on the podcast, so perhaps giving the digestive aid a shot.
Yep. Cool. All right. Next, we got a question from Joe. Rob, first off, you guys rock. Your podcast gets me through the day. First question, my girlfriend's sister-in-law has type 1 diabetes. She eats what she considers healthy, organic, lots of veggies, fish, bison, chicken, and turkey occasionally, but she eats a ton of legumes. What can I tell her or provide her to make her realize she needs to eat more protein and cut out the legumes? I need some ammo. By the way, she is currently reading Good Calories, Bad Calories.
So, gosh, I don't know. you know, this stuff of the whole, like, try to get a bunch of ammo to convert people. There's the British Medical Journal piece that talks about lectins from beans and everything from like dysentery to nephritis, like kidney problems. So you could throw that to her and see how she takes it. I just really like relying on, you know, hey, give this 30 days, see if you look, feel, perform better. If you don't, then fine, keep doing what you're doing. You know, that just appeals to me a lot more than trying to get into some sort of an intellectual battle about this. Seems like, you know, the information is good to have, I guess, to kind of form a basis intellectually, but then it's nice to just get in and play with things and see how it actually works.
Yep. Second question, my girlfriend has scoliosis. She eats mostly paleo because of me. The other day, her mother told her to take calcium supplements for her scoliosis. I told her to do a fit day calculation to identify what she may be lacking. What kind of advice can I give her on supplements to take? What helps scoliosis? Thanks in advance. Can't wait for the book.
You know, to the degree that calcium and calcium metabolism gets played into scoliosis, your best bet is doing like a paleo diet. The gut is intact, and so it can absorb nutrients. You have a nice acid-base balance. Even though, like, Matt and I have talked a lot about the acid-base balance and little dubious as to whether, you know, how impactful it is with regards to overall health, but I think you can make a good argument for it promoting bone mineral density and bone health and all that sort of jive. And then to the degree that you can, being active and doing tons of strengthening and mobility work seems to really benefit scoliosis. So that's a whole other piece to it. I can't really think of supplements that are going to be like a huge boon, you know, but keeping all the digestive processes healthy, being active, being mobile, gymnastics, weightlifting, like all that type of stuff would be really, really good for this person. Obviously graded in kind of a stepwise fashion of introduction, but that would be fantastic for her.
Yep. All right. Good. Rob, final question. Are you going to be okay?
I'm barely going to make it. Barely.
Yeah. Well, this is related to Lyle McDonald, so take a deep breath.
Woo-hoo.
Question from Anthony. Hi, Rob and Andy. I was wondering what your take was on a cyclical ketogenic diet. I was reading some of Lyle McDonald's stuff on it and wondering if I could incorporate it into my program. I tend to be fairly lean, but if I want to drop my body fat to below 10%, I have to go to the ketogenic route. This is great for me. I love how I feel on a ketogenic diet, energy, strength gains, but after a couple weeks, I barely have the energy to do a decent Metcon. The only issue I see with incorporating a paleocyclic ketogenic diet is he recommends 100 grams liquid carbs for the first post-workout meal during the carb load phase, an additional 400 to 500 grams of carbs for the next 24 to 36 hours. I know you like Cytomax, which would be okay for the liquid carb meal, but it seems damn hard to get 400 grams of paleo carbs in 24 hours. That's a hell of a lot of sweet potatoes. Anyway, love the podcast. Thanks for making us healthier.
I mean, that's a hell of a lot of whatever carbohydrate source you're using. So I'm not sure if Anthony's kind of looking for, you know, justification or advice to eat a bunch of white rice. I mean, if you want to, I think that that's a fairly comparatively benign option for a situation like this, but it's really not that much yam or sweet potato. And again, it's going to boil down to quite a bit of food to get all that done. And I would, one thing that I would back up on this is just that if there's one element of the cyclic ketogenic approach that people maybe complain about most is just when they make a really severe carbohydrate intake or you know, undergo it, they usually feel horrible. And they're kind of like, man, it's just barely worth doing this at all, given my, you know, the way that I feel on this. So I would be totally fine with you doing fewer carbs on this. You know, start off at the lower end and then work your way up and see if, you know, the results that you're getting, if each gradation upward in the carbohydrate, you should see some sort of a quantifiable improvement in how you feel and your Metcon performance and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I feel like people get a little too wrapped up in these magic ratios that people are throwing out. I mean, mm-hmm. 400 to 500 grams, is you could start with less and see how you look, feel, perform.
Yeah, yeah. And like I know I like cyclic low carb diets. You know, I it just seems easy, very, very intuitive. I do, you know, and that, like I think I've mentioned before, that on a time scale could span anything from basically like your cyclic low carb is that your carb load is every day that you work out, but you know, the rest of the 24 hours between workouts, or you know, whatever it breaks down to, is just protein and fat. Protein, veggies, fat, and so it's essentially like very, very low carb in between, kind of classic massive eating approach a la Berardi, all the way up to like a DePasquale, where you know every 7 to 10 days is when you do the carb load, and it lasts for like 2 days on the weekend, and then there's all kinds of gradation in between that, which I think are totally, totally fine. They're totally good to go.
Right. All right. Cool. McDonald, almost paleo.
Tom Furman recommended that I send Lyle, Alan Aragon, and Martin a advanced copy of the book, which I'd already talked to Martin and had his address, and was going to send him an advanced copy, but I figure I'll get probably horrific reviews from those guys because they hate the whole paleo thing. Maybe the science will stand on its own, but we'll see.
Rob, some people would argue that all publicity is good publicity.
That's true. The P.T. Barnum approach. To say whatever you want, just get my name right. So,
That's right. All right, man. Well, that's it. Rob Wolf, episode 38 in the books.
Amazing.
Another epic event. I hope you survive your time in the backwoods.
Oh, yeah. Week. Yeah. If I don't, you and Keystone can carry the torch from here on out. So
how long do you have to run barefoot in the hills?
6 miles, thereabouts. Yeah. It's going to be awesome.
I cannot wait to hear about this. Rob Wolf runs 6 miles barefoot. You should
awesome.
Take pictures of your feet.
Yeah, I have not run 6 miles in totality probably ever. I guess I have, but past couple of years, you know, I maybe logged 6 miles of running after like 3 months, so right. Interesting. See what I've got in the tank. They may send out a search and rescue party for me, so we'll see.
I'm nervous, but I wish you luck.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks,
and we'll talk to you after your trip.
Awesome. Take care.
All right. See you, man.
Bye.